It is Thursday, December 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, we'll speak to a U.S. military official in Afghanistan about the U.S.-backed Afghan government's new breakthrough in the fight against the Taliban. Beijing responds to an unprecedented security threat against Westerners. We'll get the latest from a journalist based in the Chinese capital. And we'll hear from one of our correspondents about why former U.S. hostages in Iran are so happy about a long-delayed compensation package. It's all ahead on International Edition. Officials in Afghanistan say national forces backed by U.S. airstrikes have regained control of a key district of the southern province of Helmand from Taliban militants. A U.S. military spokesman, Colonel Michael Lawhorn, confirmed to VOA that U.S. aircraft participated in the fighting in the Sangin district. Colonel Lawhorn spoke with International Edition's Ira Melman about the latest developments in Afghanistan's Taliban insurgency.
What is happening, the most importantly, is that the Afghans are the ones doing the fighting. I know there's been a lot of attention on it this week. Helmand province as a whole remains a very contested area. We've said that. We knew that this was going to be difficult throughout this year. Helmand is the main effort for the Afghan security forces. But our mission has not changed. We continue to train, devise, and assist our Afghan partners. And the Afghans are the ones that are doing the fighting in and around Sangin.
Why is Helmand so important to NATO and the combined forces and also to the Taliban?
Well, it's the traditional homeland of the Taliban. The Taliban have also made that their main effort. They have a large presence down there. And they have said for years their plan is to try to take over Helmand, and Sangin is one of the smaller provinces, but it's important to their overall effort because of where it's located. Sangin is just north of a major highway that cuts east-west across the Helmand province, and it sits on a major north-south highway. So it's both tactically important from the area that it controls, that large intersection of the two main highways that intersect in Helmand province, and also spiritually and emotionally significant to the Taliban.
What about financially as far as the poppy crop is concerned?
Well, that's obviously the source of one of the main sources of income for the various Taliban groups. And interestingly enough, that's one of the areas in which we see a lot of the conflict between the various Taliban groups in Afghanistan and the Daesh, what we could refer to as Daesh, or the ISIS groups that are trying to make headway. They're fighting with the Taliban in Afghanistan right now, and a lot of that conflict has to do with control of poppies, control of the opium, control of organized crime in and around Afghanistan as a source of fundraising for the various insurgent groups. One of the things that's important to remember, a lot of these guys who are in these groups, probably 70 to 90% of them, have been in one or more previous groups over the course of the last years. A lot of times you'll see these guys change their T-shirts, if you will. They get disaffected, disenfranchised with a certain group. They feel they might have more success joining a different group, and they move back and forth. So that's one of the things that makes it kind of hard to estimate the numbers of any particular group at any given time. But what we're seeing is a lot of conflict between Daesh, between the various Taliban groups here, and the Afghan National Army is busy fighting both of them as well.
And how are they doing?
We've seen a lot of improvement. Is it where we'd like it to be right now? It's probably not where we want it to be in the future. There's still a lot of areas for improvement, and we have some things in the works to help improve that. Early next year, you'll see the Afghans get their first delivery of fixed-wing aircraft. They're pilots that have been just graduated from training back in the United States. Afghan pilots are going to come here. They're going to start employing fixed-wing aircraft to do close air support with Afghan forces. They've done a really good job of improving the way they integrate their own helicopter. We have a new helicopter called the MD-530. It's a light helicopter armed with machine guns and some rockets, and they're able to do close air support on their own. And most importantly, they have kept the Taliban from making any strategic gains anywhere in Afghanistan in 2015.
And that was U.S. military spokesman Colonel Michael Lawhorn speaking with International Edition's Ira Melman. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
During the winter holiday season, a small town in Finland more than quadruples in population with visitors to Santa Claus Village. The picturesque little town just north of Rovaniemi is heavily dependent on tourism, with guests increasingly coming from Asia. Hong Kong visitor Gary and Guy has noticed Asians are eager to learn more about Europe.
Asia countries, they're more richer, especially for China and also Korea.
The number of Chinese traveling abroad tops 80 million a year. Sean Tipton is with the Association of British Travel Agents and says the number of holidays Europeans take has pretty much hit the saturation point.
So the really big growth market is definitely Asia, but in particular the Chinese market. Japan has always been pretty large, but China is, scope though is absolutely immense.
China's growing middle class has made it the top spender on tourism worldwide, helping to boost tourism revenues in European cities like Rovaniemi. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. The U.S. Embassy in Beijing has issued an unusual warning to its citizens of a Christmastime security threat against Westerners in one of the city's most popular expatriate districts. Beijing authorities deployed armed security personnel to the Sanlitun shopping area in response to that threat. The British, French, and Irish embassies sent out similar security warnings. For more on the situation in Beijing, I spoke on the phone a short time ago to the editor of the magazine Time Out Beijing, Lee Williamson. I asked Williamson what the scenes were like on the streets of central Beijing.
Well, in Beijing, Sanlitun, it's an awful lot quieter than it was Christmas Eve last year. I can tell you that. I was on the streets in 2014, Christmas Eve, doing their last-minute shopping. It was very bustling. The ATMs had run out of cash. It was full of both expatriates and native Chinese doing Christmas shopping. And this year was a bit of a different scenario. It was certainly not deathly quiet. Beijing is never deathly quiet, but there were far fewer people on the streets today than there would be ordinarily.
And what do you attribute that to?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for other people, but I assume it has to be the warnings that were issued by the U.S. State Department and by the British embassy as well, telling people that there was some security threats and they advising people to be cautious and to stay away from the area. It must be down to that, really. That's certainly why a lot of people didn't go to Sanlitun today that I know personally.
Well, how does this security threat compare to anything that you've seen before in Beijing?
Well, certainly I can't remember in the last couple of years there being an incident like this where there was a warning related to security that was issued before an incident that was also very, very vague. Well, no one really knows exactly what the threat is. It doesn't really compare to anything we've had recently. Usually the State Department and such give pollution warnings. The last major warning that was given out was about acid rain after the Tianjin explosions earlier this year. But a warning like this related to a security threat is, as far as I know, in the last few years at least, it hasn't happened.
Well, I want to get to the smog situation in just a moment, but what kind of presence of security forces did we see in Beijing today?
So in the Sanlitun area, which is where people were advised to avoid today, there were appeared to be military police, certainly heavily armed police, certainly heavily armed, I should say. I'm not sure if they're military police or civilian police, but heavily armed guards with machine guns and armored vehicles throughout Sanlitun, and also very heavy-duty roadblocks as well. Blocking certain key alleyways in the Sanlitun shopping area. A lot of armed guards and not so many pedestrians.
And they're saying that a lot of people are taking pictures of them as well, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I don't know how much of a storm in a teacup this is. I hope it turns out to be, a big lot of hot air over nothing and there is no eventual security breach, but it seemed like a lot of hot air today because there were maybe 10 or so that I saw, a dozen or so guards on the street, whereas everybody knew they were there, and there were dozens and dozens of people taking selfies in front of the police and taking pictures of the guards and everything like that.
And that was Lee Williamson, editor of Time Out Beijing. Now, he was also tweeting about the situation in Beijing on with his Twitter handle, which is at LeeSW1985. If you go to his Twitter handle, you can find a tweet of his that says, "Lots of armed police in Sanlitun streets, but nothing compared to the number of people taking pics of the said police," as he was just saying. And you can see one of his shots there. Another person who is posting images of the armed security personnel in Beijing was the Beijing correspondent for The Guardian newspaper, Tom Phillips. His Twitter handle is at Tom Phillips, IN. And alongside one of his photos, he posted this message: "Never seen rifle-toting armed forces in Taikoo before." Here's one other tweet about the situation in Beijing that caught my attention from a user named Steven, and his handle is at Lord Spuggy. He said, "So what's the threat against Westerners in Beijing all about, and where is it coming from? I hope this isn't more Uyghur bashing," according to Stephen. Well, Chinese authorities have blamed members of the country's mostly Muslim Uyghur minority for violent acts of terrorism in the past. Well, for more on Twitter, you can find this show on Twitter at VOA_IE, and you can also find me. I'm at Michael_Lippin. Well, moving on now to the oil situation. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, has forecast a global oil price of about $70 a barrel by the year 2020. That would be an increase from a level of about $37 a barrel today. John Demopoulos is a senior market strategist with Argus Media, which watches global energy and commodity markets. Demopoulos told VOA's Victor Beatty that the OPEC forecast is like predicting what the weather will be like in 4 years.
Looking 4 years out is always a little tricky. You know, you can see that so much has changed in the past 4 years that certainly wouldn't have been predicted back in, well, I suppose in 11 it would have been, but prior to that. I don't think we see any dramatic increase in prices, certainly not to the levels that we were seeing a year and a half ago. The days of $100 oil, they're in the past and they're a long way in the future. You know, we see not much interest from the OPEC countries in trimming their production at the moment. We see low production costs from them, and we see production costs from the swing producers in the US, the shale producers, which are certainly nothing approaching the kind of prices that we were at a year and a half ago.
You have an agreement to unify the Libyan government after years of chaos. You have Iran with its oil coming back on the market, and you have a drop in the end of the 40-year U.S. oil export ban. With these three streams of oil coming online, what's that going to do to price next year?
Things really still look pretty weak for next year. We're even seeing now this unseasonably mild winter weather really cutting into demand for heating oil, which is again having an impact on the markets and kind of continuing to push prices lower. So those three streams coming back, and we have seen pretty frequently signs of more Libyan production coming online, and then that disappears again. I don't think we can necessarily rely on that light sweet coming back, although the world's kind of got plenty of light sweet crude at the moment. The Iranian crude, that looks like more of a sure thing. The U.S. export ban, lifting that's going to have maybe some impact. But to be honest, there's not really much financial benefit at the moment to exporting U.S. crude. You know, some of it will be exported, but it's not going to go out in huge droves out of the U.S. simply because the price incentives, the price signals are not there at the moment, which really means that we're refining more of it here, so demand is up here in the United States. We're also slowing our production of crude oil here. So that's kind of rebalanced the market a little bit already, which means that there's not as much crude oil spare to export to other countries as, you know, previously would have been the case.
Well, that was John Demopoulos, a senior market strategist with Argus Media, speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
NASA's Curiosity Mars rover gave scientists a big surprise. As they reviewed data gathered by the Mars rover, scientists found that some rocks in Gale Crater contain the chemical compound silica. In fact, they say it's a very high amount of the compound. According to the researchers, silica is actually a combination of silicon and oxygen. On Earth, we normally see the compound as quartz, but it can also be found in a number of other minerals. Albert Yen, a Curiosity science team member at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, says two geological processes that can increase the concentration of silica involves water. Knowing which of the two processes took place will allow scientists to learn more about the ancient wet environments of Mars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Well, it took 36 years, but the Americans held hostage for 444 days by Iranian captors are finally getting a resolution to their ordeal. A massive spending bill that Congress passed last Friday granted up to $4 million for each of the 53 former hostages and their estates. Well, earlier I spoke to our correspondent Carol Gunsberg, and I asked her how a 1981 deal between the U.S. and Iran that freed the hostages complicated their efforts to get compensation.
The set of agreements actually barred them from suing to get compensation. That was a big problem. And over time, the hostages, because they'd suffered, thought that they should have some sort of reparation. They took it to court. They had a legal team that fought on their behalf. But the U.S. federal government opposed abrogating the accord or treaty because it felt it would compromise its ability to conduct foreign policy.
So those former captives did already receive some compensation. Can you tell us a little bit about what they have received up to this point?
Back in the early 1980s, not long after their release, each hostage did get a cash payment of $20,000. That amount was $50 for every day of their captivity. And it was based on a formula similar to what had been awarded to U.S. prisoners of war.
And what is this new amount of compensation that they're going to get? How does that compare?
The new amount is up to $4.4 million for each of the former hostages or their estate. And that amount is based on a request of $10,000 for every day in which they were held in captivity.
So how is it that the U.S. government has agreed to dramatically increase the amount of compensation, given that that 1981 treaty was still there, which had those requirements or restrictions? Has the U.S. just decided to kind of set that aside?
The legal team and members of Congress who were advocating for the hostages had come up with another funding source, and that was from penalties imposed on companies that did business with Syria, Iran, and other states involved in terrorism. Those companies paid penalties. A bank was just penalized $9 billion, $1 billion of which goes into a reparations fund for the former hostages and other victims of terror.
So how did those former captives react to the news of this new settlement?
Tom Lankford, their attorney, said he had a very emotional meeting with them, a teleconference with them on December 16th, in which many of them sobbed and cried and also were elated. There had been a lot of skepticism and anger at the U.S. government among some of the hostages for barring their efforts to obtain some compensation. So this reconciled a long, long stretch of what they saw as injustice.
And injustice for quite a lot of hardship that they had suffered while in captivity and even since then, right?
Right. The hostages, while in captivity, some of them endured beatings, pistol whipping, mock execution. There was a lot of psychological torture. Those kinds of psychological tactics preyed on a number of the hostages. As one former hostage told me, there have been suicides, there have been suicide attempts, there have been great physical difficulties afterward. People lost teeth. Their health overall was compromised for many, many people. Some still have nightmares from their 14 months in captivity.
Well, perhaps this compensation will help them to soothe some of those pains that they had suffered. Well, thanks very much to our correspondent, Carol Gunsberg, for that report.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, about 99 million households in the United States will decorate their living rooms with Christmas trees this year. And while artificial trees have grown in popularity in recent years, for many Americans, it doesn't get more traditional than going to a tree farm to get a fresh-cut natural tree. VOA's Ariadne Budianto takes us to one such farm in Great Falls, Virginia, right outside of Washington.
Visiting a Christmas tree farm in search of the perfect tree is what many American families do at Christmas time, including this young family.
We have our Christmas tree. Yeah, we're gonna take it home and decorate it and put it in a stand. It's kind of a backwards concept to take a tree from outside and bring it indoors, but.
Yeah, putting lights on it and.
And ornaments.
And stuff.
Lots of ornaments, and you collect the ornaments for years. I've got ones from since I was like 5 years old, and it's fun.
Abby has been coming to Crops Crops since she was seven. For her, buying a Christmas tree at this local tree farm brings back lots of childhood memories and preserves her family tradition. During Christmas season, visitors can also buy holiday decorations, such as poinsettias, wreaths, and ornaments. The farm also sells seasonal vegetables, local honey, and handicrafts all year round. Larry Kropp is the owner of this 8-hectare farm, which employs three generations of the Kropp family.
There's a lot of customers that come in, and when they come in, they say, Larry, this is our 22nd, 23rd, 24th year. We go back to 86, so it's almost 30 years coming up next year that we've been selling trees up here.
Although he has employees, Kropp relies more on his children.
Basically your own boss, even though I do work for my dad, we do what we know is what we need to get done. Being able to come up with ideas of and new ideas of things that we can do for the business and other side businesses that we can work off the land.
Like they are now?
It takes about 5 to 10 years for these trees to reach ideal height, between 1 and 4 meters. Prices vary from $48 to $400. The Fraser and Canadian firs are bestsellers. After someone finds the perfect tree, the staff will clean and bale it to make sure the needles do not damage the customer's car on their way home. For almost 30 years, Crops Crops has played an important role in preserving the Christmas tradition for families around the Washington area. From Great Falls, Virginia, Ariadna Budianto, VOA News.
And that's it for VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. For all those celebrating, have a Merry Christmas.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Belarus recently convened the second Working Group for Democracy and Human Rights. The two sides discussed their shared OSCE commitments to uphold freedoms of expression, peaceful assembly, and association. The importance of facilitating space for the development of civil society and independent media, and best practices in the area of rule of law. The United States welcomed Belarus's release of 6 political prisoners in August and urged Belarus to take additional positive steps in the areas of democracy and human rights. In particular, the United States called on Belarus to take steps to conduct its upcoming parliamentary elections in line with the standards of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The United States noted that enhanced respect for democracy and human rights in Belarus is fundamental to improving bilateral relations and is essential to the prosperity of the country. The United States also remains committed to supporting Belarusian sovereignty, territorial integrity, and independence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.